It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. Is Harvard showing racial bias against Asians and Asian Americans? One group called Students for Fair Admissions says yes. A coalition of 156 Asian American groups backed the suit, but Students for Fair Admissions has a history of antagonism against affirmative action. Still, there may be evidence that Harvard stereotyped Asian applicants in their admission process. Nick Anderson is helping us suss this out. He covers higher education for The Washington Post. Nick, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Carrie. Thanks for having me.
So this anti-affirmative action organization that just formed within the last year, it's called Students for Fair Admissions, sued Harvard University last month, alleging that Harvard discriminates against Asian American applicants in its admission process. So explain the case for us.
Okay, well, actually, the suit traces to 2014. The group formed several years ago, and the idea here is that they want to challenge the very notion that colleges can take into account race and ethnicity when they think about choosing a freshman class. Now, this has been litigated before. There have been a long series of affirmative action in college admission cases going back to the 1970s. And what the Supreme Court has said in those cases in various ways is, yes, you may take race and ethnicity into account, but in the recent decisions the Supreme Court has issued, it has steadily narrowed and specified the criteria where you can do that. And basically it boils down to you can't have quotas, you can't set a specific target of the number of, say, African Americans that you want to have in your class, you can't use race and ethnicity as the only criterion. You must also take into account, if possible, race-neutral alternatives and consider those. So that's the Supreme Court's direction so far. What this case tries to do, and this plaintiff is saying, is like it's trying to say, let's toss that whole thing out and get rid of the very notion of what the plaintiffs say is illegal discrimination against certain racial groups because other racial groups are getting favored.
So this is causing quite a bit of a stir in the Asian American community. Talk to me about who Edward Blum is.
Okay, so Edward Blum is the organizer and president of Students for Fair Admissions. This is a group that's based in Arlington, Virginia. And Students for Fair Admissions has also promoted and been plaintiff in lawsuits in North Carolina and Texas that are arguing similar issues in the same general space. But the group itself would tell you that it is a membership group and that among its members are some Asian Americans who have been damaged by Harvard policy.
And do they name them?
No.
Okay, so how do we know that that's true?
Well, there have been legal maneuverings behind the scenes before the trial takes place through the process of discovery and depositions. So the lawyers for Harvard and the lawyers for Students for Fair Admissions have been grilling each side to try to obtain what you would say is basically advance evidence, the words of the key players involved. And so I'm sure that some of that will come out in court. But the lawyers at Harvard have really gone hard after the notion that this group represents Asian Americans. And they have claimed that this group doesn't have standing to sue. Now, interestingly, the judge in the case has so far not agreed and has not permitted this case to be thrown out on that basis. So right now, the group has standing and the suit is moving forward.
There's a term that has been thrown out here called racial mascotting. Talk to me about that.
Mascotting?
Yes.
Not familiar with that so much, but let's try racial balancing. Okay. Racial balancing is a term that the Justice Department under President Trump used the other day when it effectively weighed in on the idea of the suit moving forward. The Justice Department, as you know, has an interest in this in these kinds of cases because it gives them a chance to sort of weigh in with the legal system on matters of significant policy. In this case, the Justice Department agreed with the plaintiff that there is strong evidence that Harvard is engaging in what's known as racial balancing when it carries out the very final actions of selecting a class. And the Justice Department says that if that's so, that could really be something that would test the limits of what the Supreme Court has said is legal and constitutional.
I should note that I got the term racial mascotting from an NPR story interview. It's the idea that Asian Americans are being essentially used as pawns for the broader aim of dismantling affirmative action.
Okay. Well, you know, I get that. So that is, I suppose, an argument that's going to resonate with many people. You have in these kinds of college admissions, really intense feelings. Harvard, remember, gets about 40,000 plus applicants a year from around the world and in the United States, and it only lets in less than 5% of those applicants. So you've got a lot of people with ambition and who have been turned away. So those folks who are turned away, and this is not just true of Harvard, by the way, it's true of a lot of selective colleges, highly selective colleges. There's great competition for those colleges. They are then going to look at the results, namely students who have been rejected, and they're going to say, I wonder why.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're going to feel extremely strongly about that, and they're going to search for a reason why. Now, one reason why they are saying here could be because of my race or my ethnicity. And so then if that's the case, then you're likely to look very, very negatively upon the very concept of affirmative action. And, you know, you're likely to say, well, let's find the a way to dismantle that system.
So I have
to
ask you,
behold, here is a way that somebody has thought up to try to dismantle the system.
So
the grievances of Asian Americans.
So I have to ask you, we are in the middle of the Brett Kavanaugh hearings. There have been a lot of conservative judges who have been appointed. Do you see, in terms of higher education, this idea of affirmative action going away in the future?
Well, the courts have suggested in recent rulings that this is not a forever policy. I'm talking about the Supreme Court.
Right.
The Supreme Courts have said, by the way, with rather narrow margins, they have upheld the status quo. So it only takes a little bit of a change on the court to flip the decisions here. But the courts have said that this policy is not going to be around forever, but in the interim, and whatever the interim is, you know, you may do it under these restrictions. So I think that could be under question in the near future.
We have been talking to Nick Anderson. He covers higher education for The Washington Post. Thanks, Nick. I appreciate you being on.
Thank you, Carrie. Have a good day.
It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Thank you. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. Libel, slander, defamation. Every journalist worth his salt knows the meaning of these. It's drilled into us. And Donald Trump seems to know the meaning of these, but he doesn't seem to like them as they're currently defined. Yesterday, after a conversation with Bob Woodward about his forthcoming book on the Trump White House, Trump tweeted that he thinks Congress should change libel laws in order to keep journalists from making up stories, as he put it. Then, of course, one of Trump's senior aides penned an anonymous op-ed in the New York Times yesterday, saying the president was amoral and not moored to any discernible first principles that guide his decision-making. Strong words that Trump repudiated, but it brings up a lot of questions. Eric Uglin is a professor of digital media and performing arts at Marquette University. He teaches classes on media law and policy. Eric, welcome to the program.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. So, as usual, when we journalists and when politicians and commentators think that they're going to be talking about one thing, we get waylaid by something that comes out of the White House that causes us to broaden our scope a little bit. So let's talk about this op-ed before we get to libel laws. It essentially said that the president is not capable of running the country and that his staff has been stepping in to keep him from making any major mistakes. What say you about this?
Well, it's extraordinary. It's extraordinary in a lot of ways. We don't see this kind of disclosure from people inside the White House while they are still working for the White House. So that's unusual. The fact that this person has done this anonymously is unusual, and claims to be working with others in the White House, so that there is not just a single person, but multiple people within the administration who are engaged in this this kind of oversight function, sabotage, some people might call it. And it's also unusual for a news organization like the New York Times to publish an anonymous contribution like this. And so it's really a sort of daring move on the part of all involved. The person who's making this disclosure, it's daring in the sense that I think this person will ultimately be revealed through an investigation within the White House, or the person might simply come forward at some point. And I think, frankly, that will happen soon.
Right.
And it's it's unusual for the it's daring on the part of the New York Times, in the sense that they're putting their reputation on the line, and if these claims turn out to be false, if they've been sort of duped or hoaxed in some way, then they will have to answer for it.
And we know
they feel very confident that this person is credible.
So we know with the Iraq War, though, that things were coming out of the White House, coming out of the vice president's office, that turned out to be wrong, that the New York Times was being played on that.
Well, it's true. I mean, there's the risk that they've been duped in some way. But my guess is that they're not just responding to some anonymous contribution. They've had some, conversations with this person. They know who it is. They've probably, have multiple people, including the lawyers, involved in the sort of conversation with this person. So I'm sure they're quite confident that this person exists, that this is not a hoax. They might even have some sort of fallback so that if it's revealed that these disclosures are false in some way, that they have the ability to identify the person publicly.
So there are two things that come up for me. One is that now President Trump is not going to take any advice from his senior advisors because he's not going to trust that any of them aren't just playing him. So I wonder at the timing of this, why do this while he's still in office? So that's the first thing. Let's talk about that first.
Yeah, well, you could say this is sort of a cowardly act by this person to essentially save their reputation, with the assumption that at some point the person will come forward or will be outed, and that he or she is simply trying to preserve his long-term reputation by disassociating himself or herself at this stage from the White House. We've seen other people who have said this, that they don't want their long-term prospects to be hampered by an association with this administration. And so this may be a way of kind of preemptively saving face. To the extent that the White House was chaotic before this, it's going to be mayhem now because, I'm envisioning people hooked up to lie detectors this morning you know, I'm sure there will be an investigation within the White House. Trump is dogmatic about loyalty, and at least he demands it from others.
But what this brings up is who's going to do the investigating? I mean,
well, yeah, exactly. And this might not be some sort of, you know, criminal investigation. It may simply be you know, conversations with people in the White House. I think there will be some frank, you know, interpersonal conversations, and frankly, people in the White House who are still loyal to Trump will want to identify these people and root them out. So there will be a lot of suspicion and interrogation to try to determine who, you know, try to figure out who this person is.
So the second thing that this brings up for me, though, is that let's take Trump out of the equation, right? We have just learned that the advisors to the president of the United States have essentially been ignoring him and doing what they want to do and kind of using him as a puppet for their own aims. Does that seem to you problematic?
It is problematic in the sense that if we say that this is a new normal, it's really not a way to run any administration, and it's not good public service in the long run if this is the standard. So in the short term, critics of President Trump might relish this, but in the long term, it creates a sort of hazardous precedent. Now, you could say that this is just a one-off situation because it's just quite unusual, and that's probably true. But I think it's I think you could say that it's an act of political disloyalty. It is not true, as President Trump tried to claim on Twitter the other day, that this is treasonous.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's also not entirely clear, because the op-ed doesn't go into a lot of detail, what specific things this person or group of people have been doing. So they mentioned things like removing papers from his desk to sort of delay his decision-making on certain things, and maybe cooler heads will prevail if they can just buy some time. And that kind of thing is, you know, perhaps bad behavior on the part of an employee, but it's not treasonous, it's not illegal, it's, and you know, so, anyway, that's...
Got it. We have a caller, Saeed, welcome from Green Bay. Welcome to the program.
Yes, good morning. Thank you very much for taking my call. I'm quite concerned about this. I'm not questioning the individual judgment as to how they perceive the world, but they are substituting their judgment for the judgment of millions of people that voted for this man, whether we agree with it or we don't. It concerns me that the standards of journalism have been lowered to the point that this kind of thing can get published. One could even ask, does this person exist? Without proof, and it also concerns me. I don't know where this person is located. If this person is located within the State Department, is this person located within the national security apparatus? It concerns me that we have potentially someone with a lack of courage to stand up and be accountable for their assessment by telling us who he is sitting potentially within the national security apparatus. And sabotaging the very person that is picked by our process to be our president. This is quite concerning. It doesn't show courage. It shows lack of courage, because I would give this man a lot more, or woman, a lot more credibility if I knew who they were. The end they're trying to achieve, if they in fact do exist, by publishing this, would be far more advanced if we knew who they were and they were accountable and we could question them. So I believe this is a new standard of law in journalism, and I believe this is a new standard of law in our national political discourse, as some are celebrating this.
Thank you very much, Saeed, we've got to go. Thank you. That was an important point. What say you to this, Eric?
Yeah, I mean, there are a couple of issues here, and there are different players involved. So we could look at the behavior of the individual and whether or not that is, acceptable for a government employee, or whether this is essentially a kind of sabotage. or, you know, disloyal to not only the president but to the country by, as the caller said, substituting this person's judgment about policy for that of the president. And so on that score, you know, I think it sort of depends on the magnitude of what this person was actually doing. Again, if it's just sort of understanding the temperament of the president, recognizing that he is impulsive, that he does change his mind from time to time, and using little tactics to sort of delay decision-making on certain issues, that's not as severe as if somebody is actively trying to shift public policy. And I don't know if there's any evidence that that's really happened. We'll see if there's more information.
So this is my last question on this. Yeah. We've got to move on to libel. But I do want to, one of the things that the op-ed did say, actually, we're going to go to a break, and then we'll come back in a moment. We are talking about what's going on in terms of what has happened in the White House in the last couple of days. We will take your calls when we come back, 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. It's The Morning Show. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. We're looking at libel law and how it applies to the president versus ordinary people. President Trump lamented yesterday that libel laws should be changed, rhetoric that he used on the campaign trail when he said the laws should be changed so it would be easier to sue journalists. We are taking your calls on this, 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas at WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. We've been talking to Eric Uglin. He's a professor of digital media and performing arts at Marquette University. He teaches classes on media, law, and policy. Eric, I have to tell you that your interests are totally my interest, law, performing arts, and media. I think that's pretty awesome.
Well, so we should do a profession switch at some point.
We should do. We could easily do. Like, are you a law professor?
I teach in the law school occasionally. I mostly teach in the College of Communication to students who are going into different communication fields.
This is totally up my alley. So here, I want to start here with a definition. Just a basic definition of libel and slander. Let's start with libel.
Sure. Well, let's talk first about the broader term. The broader term that some people might be familiar with is defamation.
Mm-hmm.
So a defamation or defamatory statement is a false statement about somebody that harms their reputation or their standing in the community. So the key thing there is that the information is false.
Mm-hmm.
So you can never successfully sue somebody if what they publish about you is true. You can't successfully sue them for libel or defamation if what they publish is true.
Right.
And we're also talking about harm to your reputation. So it's not about hurt feelings. It's not about embarrassment. It's about whether or not the public will think less of you as a result of these disclosures. So that's defamation, broadly speaking. And then it comes in two varieties. So one is libel, where somebody publishes a defamatory statement in print or on a website or through a broadcast. And then there's slander, which is a spoken libel. And for all practical purposes, the two are synonymous in terms of what the plaintiff has to prove and so on and the defenses that are available. So there's really not a meaningful distinction between the two. The most significant distinction is really a practical one, which is slander. Which is that slander occurs in small groups, you know, or with a smaller audience, and so the damages won't be as great as in a case where something is published and disseminated to a larger audience.
Okay, so one of the things that you just said that I find interesting is that it has to be false. But I'm going to go with the case of Hulk Hogan, who sued Gawker and won. With the help of Peter Thiel, what happened, what he was suing them about was true. He did have an affair, but he was suing them because they publicized something that was private. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, exactly. So that suit is different in the sense that that was a claim that was at its root about privacy. So it is the case that if you publish something about somebody that is true, that nevertheless invades their privacy in some significant way, they can potentially sue you for that claim. And there are a number of different privacy claims that someone could bring. But that's distinct from defamation, which deals with information that harms somebody's reputation.
Okay, and there is a distinction between there's a higher level of evidence that you have to bring if you say something about a public figure rather than somebody that you just met in a grocery store.
Yeah, so starting in 1964, the Supreme Court issued a number of decisions on libel and essentially constitutionalized libel. In other words, they said that state laws regarding libel had to be consistent with the First Amendment. And according to the Supreme Court, the First Amendment, First Amendment principles would be undermined if public officials could sue their critics too easily. So they raised the bar, saying that if a public if a public official sues for defamation, he or she has to prove that the information is false. So they have that burden, and they have to prove that it was published with reckless disregard for the truth. So they're making it more challenging for public officials to sue for libel and win because they didn't want public officials to use libel as a kind of weapon to silence their critics. And that principle was then extended in the a few years later, actually, to public figures. So now any public person, whether it's Donald Trump or a school superintendent or Aaron Rodgers or Bill Gates, all public people have this higher burden of proof in order to win a libel suit.
And so when President Trump talks about Congress should change libel laws, that's what he's talking about, isn't it? That they should change libel laws so that public people can sue their critics. And if that happens, would that even be constitutional?
Well, probably not. It depends on what exactly he has in mind. I mean, there's the practical barrier, which is that there is no federal libel law. Libel law is governed by individual states. Hmm. And then those state laws have to be consistent with the First Amendment principles articulated by the Supreme Court. So there's nothing the federal government can do practically to completely upend or alter libel law, because what really drives libel law and the things that I think that concern President Trump come out of those precedents from the Supreme Court. And those can't be changed unless it's through a constitutional amendment, or unless the Supreme Court changes its mind. So there's really nothing the president can do. There's nothing even Congress can do to meaningfully alter libel law. I mean, they could pass a law to create some uniformity with regard to certain libel principles, but they couldn't take any action that subverts the principles articulated by the Supreme Court.
We are talking...
They couldn't change, for example, the requirement that public officials have to prove that content was published with actual malice,
right?
The technical term for this idea that they have to show that the information was published with reckless disregard for the truth. The federal government couldn't do anything about that. They couldn't change that standard because that comes from the court.
We are talking to Eric Uglin. He's a professor of digital media and performing arts at Marquette University, and he teaches about media law and policy. I'd like to listen, Eric, to what the president said earlier this year about libel laws. These comments came in response to Michael Wolff's controversial book, Fire and Fury.
Our current libel laws are a sham and a disgrace and do not represent American values or American fairness. So we're going to take a strong look at that. We want fairness. You can't say things that are false, knowingly false, and be able to smile as money pours into your bank account.
You can't say things that are knowingly false that are going to make you money. I think that's a really interesting thing that he puts together there. But what he says are false. I mean, he was accusing Bob Woodward of making up facts for his book, which hasn't even come out yet. But the Bob Woodward talked to people in the Trump White House about what was going on in the White House. So was everybody making up facts? I mean, how do you square these things? How do you figure out what the lies are?
Well, I mean, his critique is really puzzling because he's complaining about people not being held accountable in the law for knowingly publishing false facts about people. And that's exactly what libel law does. So he absolutely, if the facts that he's asserting are true, that somebody has knowingly, you know, concocted or has distorted facts and published those about him or other public figures, they can absolutely sue for libel. It's just that, you know, the threshold is pretty high. We make it difficult for public people to sue and win because, as the Supreme Court said, we want robust, wide-open communication, uninhibited communication about public issues. And so we're going to set the bar high for public people. We don't want there to be a kind of a chilling effect. But you absolutely can still sue for defamation. In fact, President Trump has done this many times, and mm-hmm. he threatens to sue all the time, but he has, in fact, sued a number of times as well. So I'm not sure what his particular concern is about libel law, because the things he's complaining about are actionable under libel law.
And if he sued, say, Bob Woodward for defamation, would that suit go forward?
So we'd have to look at the individual claims that he's objecting to. Mm-hmm. But the burden would be on him as a public figure, public official, to show that the information published by Woodward is false. So it's not Woodward's burden to prove that the information is true.
Mm-hmm.
So he has that initial burden of showing that the information is false, that it defames him, and in other words, it lowers his standing in the community or hurts his reputation, and that it was published with reckless disregard for the truth. And if Bob Woodward is relying on very credible sources, it's unlikely that the president would be able to prove that he published these things with knowledge of their falsity or with reckless disregard for the truth.
So as far as you know, have any other presidents or policymakers in recent history expressed the desire to change libel laws?
I don't recall any president making a comment about libel specifically. I don't think there's been any movement to do that. Usually it's in the opposite direction, to make it to strengthen libel law. For example, Congress passed a law that said that state courts and courts in the United States don't have to enforce libel judgments from foreign courts. So they passed that law back in, I think it was 2010. No major reforms that I can recall have been proposed recently by a president.
We are talking about the latest issues to come out of the White House today. Right now, we're talking about libel laws with Eric Ueglin. He's a professor of digital media and performing arts at Marquette University. We're taking your calls here today, 800-642-1234, ideas at WPR.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. We're going to be back with more from Eric and your calls in a moment. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. Alex Jones is being sued for slandering the families of Sandy Hook victims. His counterclaim is that they can't sue because they're being held to a higher standard because they're well-known people. But they argue that his slander made them well-known people. We're looking at how libel laws work and who they can be used against. 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Eric Ueglin, we have got a call here, and I want to go to Troy in Muskego. Welcome to the program, Troy.
Hello. I just want to say it's almost humorous, like the irony here, where you have a president who right away becomes a defamation against him when he himself is a person that randomly makes up lies and conspiracy theories and does it himself.
Interesting, excellent point there, Troy. Eric, our president has admitted that he didn't necessarily know that, you know, that he has walked back facts or walked back things he said.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there are a number of tweets that he's put out there that are potentially could be the basis of a libel suit. He, in 2017, I think it was, tweeted about Joe Scarborough after Joe Scarborough said something critical of him. He basically, in a tweet, suggested that Joe Scarborough was responsible for the death of one of his interns. So, I mean, if that's not libelous, I don't know what is.
Right.
Oddly enough, there is a law in a federal law that protects federal employees from civil suits for behavior they engage in the context of their official duties. And so suing Trump is probably impossible because of that law, the Westfall Act, at least while he's in office and at least while, to the extent it relates to his official duties. And that this is defined very broadly. So any sort of political dialogue on Twitter would still fall into that category. But there's another interesting aspect of this, which is that, as the caller suggests, President Trump's reputation is not exactly pristine and is known to, you know, launch conspiracy theories and that sort of thing. There is a thing in libel law that we call the libel-proof plaintiff, that there are some people whose reputations are already so shattered, or the people who are already so, you know, disreputable, that they can't plausibly bring a libel suit because there's no aspect of their reputation left to preserve. Now, usually this is used for, you know, mobsters and serial killers and people like that. But some have suggested that presidents, and not just President Trump, but presidents in general ought to be put in that category as well, because it's not really it's a strained argument to suggest that somebody could publish anything today that would meaningfully harm the reputation of a president, much less President Trump.
We are talking about libel laws. Thank you, Troy, for that call. We're talking about libel laws, as President Trump tweeted yesterday, that he thinks Congress should change libel laws so that people like Bob Woodward wouldn't be able to write books. And as Eric Uglin, our guest today, pointed out, Congress can't change libel laws because there are no federal libel laws. I want to get to this Alex Jones thing, because this is fascinating to me. Alex Jones put out a conspiracy theory that said the families at Sandy Hook were actors, and this was a false flag. This was a conspiracy to take away people's guns. People then took this conspiracy theory and acted on this and harassed the families so that at least one family had to move a few times because people would actually show up at their house. They are suing him for libel. His counter to this is, you are public figures, and so the standard is higher, and they're standing there saying, but we're public figures because you libeled us. So talk to me about that case.
Yeah, it's really, first of all, they do have, I believe the families have a very credible case against Alex Jones in the sense that he has spread a truly awful rumor about them. So there's two aspects of this that we could address. One is whether or not anything Alex Jones says at this point is credible enough to be the basis of a libel suit. In other words, Alex Jones is kind of like the news of the world tabloid. I mean, it's just one lunatic rant after another. And it could come, this could be an issue that comes up in court. Oddly enough, to defend himself, he might suggest that nobody takes what he says seriously and it's just all bluster.
Okay, so my memory banks are telling me that Carol Burnett actually sued one of those tabloids way, 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 way long time ago and won.
She did. She did. They claimed that she had gotten drunk at a restaurant or something and made a scene, and it was completely false. She sued the National Enquirer and got a judgment for many millions of dollars. I forget the exact amount. And so that's a good example of the fact that public people can still sue and win. They're not without a remedy. But often public officials and public figures don't bother to sue for libel because it's a long process, it's expensive, and they can potentially trigger what's called the Streisand effect, which is that you're just going to draw more attention to it than if you just left it alone and moved on. And this is based on Barbara Streisand's objections to people filming and taking photos of her house in Malibu or wherever it was on the coast of California. And her objections to this and the attempts to try to stop people just drew more attention to her house and where it was. And so this is one of the reasons that public people often don't sue for libel. They don't want to look like bad sports, and they don't want to draw more attention to the issue. And it's expensive. And so so they'll often just drop it. But the other aspect of the Sandy Hook case is this underlying question of whether or not the family members are public figures or private figures, because, again, the burden is much higher for public people to sue and win. There's a split in the courts about this, whether the very allegation of defamation can't be the basis for saying that somebody is a public figure. But where their courts are sort of split is whether somebody can be involuntarily made a public figure through the act of somebody else, in this case, a shooter.
Right.
Or whether they have to intentionally sort of assert themselves into a public controversy. Now, I would say in this case, probably Alex Jones' team is going to argue that the fact that the family has done interviews or somehow had interactions with the media in response to this tragedy is enough to make them public figures. And it's called a limited purpose public figure. It doesn't mean they're public figures in all contexts, but in this particular context, it would make them a public figure. But that's an open question and will be a key one for the court to resolve.
Did you, by the way, see the father of one of the Parkland victims try to go up and shake hands with Brett Kavanaugh yesterday?
I did, yeah.
I don't know what that means. Kavanaugh turned away from him. Does that mean that this is going to be an issue facing the Supreme Court in the future, and Kavanaugh didn't want to be seen as shaking hands with him?
No, I mean, I think I can understand the father's motivation, and obviously he suffered a horrible loss and has really tried to make this an important public policy issue and get this on the national agenda, gun control. Kavanaugh's response, could be interpreted different ways. I mean, to me, it looked like just an icy glare because he felt like he was being
accosted.
Accosted, yeah. And it looked like maybe a stunt, and I think he just didn't want to be part of that. So who knows how to interpret that one.
In the last minute we have here, I want to talk about this. There's a lawsuit by a former contestant on The Apprentice, and an appeals judge did rule that President Trump must be deposed in this defamation lawsuit. What are the questions here, and is he going to be deposed?
Yeah, and first of all, he doesn't have immunity here because these things occurred outside the scope of his official duties as president, and it occurred before he was in office. So her claim is that he has libeled her by suggesting that her claims of being groped were an attempt to gain fame and notoriety, and were obviously false. That's what that's the source of the claim there. A false story designed to advance her own career and so on. So she's saying that this is...
You got about 5 seconds here. Will he be deposed?
It's entirely possible that he'll be deposed.
Okay.
But I honestly can't say with certainty.
Eric Uglin is a professor of digital media and performing arts at Marquette University. Eric, thanks for being with us today.
All right, no problem. Thank you.
It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.